This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. It was one of Barack Obama's last official acts as president. On September 24th, 2016, thousands gathered on the National Mall.
James Baldwin once wrote, "For while the tale of how we suffer and how we are delighted and how we may triumph is never new, it always must be heard." Today, as so many generations have before, we gather on our National Mall to tell an essential part of our American story.
President Obama spoke at the opening ceremony for the National Museum of African American History and Culture. It took about a century to open such a museum since the idea first arose. More than 30,000 people were there on opening weekend. Timed entry tickets are free, but even today, they sometimes still run out months in advance. Joining us in the studio is the museum's founding director, Lonnie Bunch. Today, he is the 14th secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, overseeing all 19 museums, including that one, 21 libraries, 9 research centers, and a zoo. His new book is called A Fool's Errand: Creating the National Museum of African American History and Culture in the Age of Bush, Obama, and Trump. Secretary Bunch, welcome to 1A.
I'm very glad to be with you.
When you hear President Obama, that clip of him speaking at the opening, what goes through your head? What goes through your heart when you hear that?
First, a sense of relief that we pulled it off.
That it's done.
But secondly, it reminded me of America at its best. It was the day when President Obama, President Bush, people crossed political lines, racial lines, economic lines to do something that would help a country. So for me, whenever I hear that, I smile and think of, I can't believe we actually did it.
Is there that feeling of barely crossing the finish line or blazing across the finish line with flying colors? Or like, how do you reflect on the finishing of that museum?
Well, I think that we went across with great fervor. We ran quickly. The reality is that it was harder to figure out how to open the museum, who gets to speak, who gets the seat, than it was building the museum. I was lucky to put together a gifted staff who basically pushed us across the finish line.
I want to talk more about how that museum came to be, but let me back up for a second. You are the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. What does that mean? What does the secretary do?
When I first went to work for the Smithsonian, I didn't even know what the secretary was. And now I realize that the secretary's job is basically to be the CEO of the Smithsonian, to oversee the museums, the research center, the zoo, to help it get the resources it needs, to work with, as its representative, with Congress, and basically to chart a vision of what a great institution could be made even greater.
Can you give us a sense of just how vast the Smithsonian is? I mean, saying 19 museums and libraries and a zoo, the Smithsonian is a behemoth in like the world scope of museums and research. It's gigantic.
The Smithsonian is the largest museum complex and research complex in the world. It's bigger than several universities. Basically, there are 7,000 people who work every day to look at science, art, history, culture. And so for me, it really is one of the great opportunities to shape and educate the country.
What are some of the things the Smithsonian does that maybe the average person might not think is part of the Smithsonian?
I think people don't realize how much research is at the heart of the Smithsonian. When you think recently that many of us saw that amazing image of the black hole, that was done by Smithsonian scientists. When you think about doing research in Panama about tropical research, that's a Smithsonian endeavor. So I think in a way, the research is something people don't know much about. And then I think it's also the educational component, that we really want to educate kids around the country, not just in Washington.
Let's talk about the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Some of my friends affectionately refer to it as the Blacksonian. I hope you don't mind that term. I will use the official name.
Thank
but
you.
In case it comes up in an email, that will not disqualify the email. I just want you to know. Talk about your work as the founding director. What were the main things that you were responsible for doing?
Everything. The reality is that we began with a staff of 2. We had no idea where the museum would be. We had no collections, no money. So my job was both to chart a vision of what this museum could be. What is the role of an African-American museum in the 21st century? It was also then to build the staff, to get the resources, to raise the money, to convince Congress to support us, to figure out what in all is said and done, what's in the museum? What are the stories you tell? And then how do you find the collections that you have to use to tell those stories? So basically, it was really starting from scratch.
Now, there are already phenomenal museums of African American history across the country. There's the Wright Museum in Detroit. There's a great museum in on Sistrunk Boulevard in Fort Lauderdale. There's the Schomburg Collection in New York. How do you figure out where a Smithsonian Museum fits into that without cannibalizing from the other museums?
Well, first of all, there was never any attempt to hurt the other museums. Because I once worked at the California African American Museum, I know about those institutions. So the goal was that the Smithsonian would, first of all, be a national institution. It would allow us to tell stories that you don't tell in Los Angeles or Chicago or Detroit. But also, because it's a national museum, it gets attention to the local museums. So when people come to Washington, we'd say, go back to the DeSable in Chicago. Look at the California African American Museum. So the goal was to basically stimulate a conversation about African American history and culture, whether it's in Washington or whether it's in local communities.
There's also, I think, the challenge, and I've been to some of these museums. I'm from South Florida, so I've been to the one in Fort Lauderdale. We were at the Wright Museum in Detroit this year for an Across America event. These museums are already pretty august. Like, you walk into the Wright Museum, I mean, you if it doesn't take your breath away, you got a hole in your soul. But then you have to figure out how to tell the story of Black people in America from, like, slavery to now, mm-hmm. in a way that's never been done. How did you begin to conceive of a new way to tell our story that would make people want to come see it?
Well, first of all, we spent 2 years doing research, interviewing people, doing focus groups, really understanding what the public knew and what they didn't know. And then we married that with the best scholarship around the country to say, all right, how do we take what the scholars want? And then I asked the curators to bring their expertise to say, what story should we tell? And ultimately for us, what was the most important thing was to say that this wasn't a story of Black people for Black people, that it was a story that said the African-American experience has shaped us all, that it's the quintessential American story. And once we came up with that as the foundation, everything else flowed.
We heard some stories from those of you who have been to this museum and were particularly struck by it. Here's what one listener left in our inbox.
My name is Avis. I'm calling from Philadelphia. I just wanted to express how much I enjoy going to the African-American Museum at the Smithsonian. The most powerful moment for me was actually entering on the basement level, going through the belly of the beast, if you will, the actual slave ship. It was so overwhelming, and it was so spiritually overwhelming to go upstairs and see and touch the Bible that was used by Nat Turner.
Thank you very much for sharing that story with us. And that is similar to the experience I think pretty much everyone has when they go through that museum. Just to be clear, for those of you who haven't been, their culture floors are up and the history floors are down. And when you enter the museum, you go down an escalator or stairs, and then you take an elevator down 3 levels to the bottom where you start in slavery times and you work your way up the museum. It's kind of one continuous ramp path that takes you back up to the level you loaded in on. Why did you decide to organize the museum that way?
I realize that most people don't understand African American history, don't understand the narrative, the sweep. And I really felt it was crucially important to say, let you understand how this community began and to help you understand how that community has shaped our notions of citizenship, our notions of independence. And so to take you from slavery through the present, and then to help you go up higher to see how this community has shaped the culture of America, how it shaped our military experience. So the goal was to give you not a linear march to progress, but to understand that it's been a struggle back and forth. But that struggle has really helped to make a country better, not just a people better.
It's also extremely emotional to walk through. Like, when you come out on that floor, the area that deals with slavery is clamped, it's cramped, it's narrow, the ceiling is low, the light is kind of in slats, like the slats of a slave ship. It's really, like, it's almost scary the minute you get off that elevator.
We spent a lot of time thinking about emotion. that I wanted people to care. If you notice when you walk through the museum, things are at human scale. So therefore, you're seeing the faces of the enslaved or people who struggled for the civil rights movement, because I wanted you to feel their emotion. And once you felt that emotion, then we knew you'd care about the stories we tell.
I'd love to know what you learned from founding this museum that helps you as the Secretary of the Smithsonian when we continue our conversation with Lonnie Bunch. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Bayer. From advances in health to innovations in agriculture, Bayer is advancing science for a better life. Because someone with heart issues should still be able to have their heart jump with joy. Because a farmer using less water should still be able to grow their crops. Because someone getting older should still be able to act young. At Bayer, this is why we science.
In 1987, dozens of federal agents surrounded a trailer park in Ozark, Missouri. Their target, a white supremacist threatening violent revolution.
I have eight teams of freedom fighters prepared to start a race war nationwide.
The agents fired tear gas, arrested him, and found a massive arsenal.
C4 plastic explosives, hand grenades, thousands of rounds of ammunition.
So years later, why did the FBI stop watching him? That story on Embedded from NPR.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are speaking with Lonnie Bunch, the Secretary of the Smithsonian Institution and the founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture here in Washington. How is the Smithsonian funded?
The Smithsonian is probably 70% funded from federal government and 30% from either earned income or private fundraising. So that it really is a kind of important public-private partnership that allows us to be an educational institution, to do research, and to be the museums and the zoos that people love.
Any prospect of charging any kind of admission fees for any part of the Smithsonian?
I think that we want the Smithsonian to be free. You need to sort of have tickets when you're at Cooper Hewitt in New York. But we really think that our job is to recognize that the American public has already paid their admission fee through their taxes, and we want them to come and enjoy the wonders of the Smithsonian.
Are there areas of the Smithsonian where you feel like it's either in excellent shape in terms of funding, or where you really wish that you had more resources to do something that the institution is kind of stretching to do?
There is always, much like a political campaign, there's always the perpetual fundraising. The reality is that the Smithsonian always needs to do new exhibits, new programs, support new research initiatives, so that in essence, there will always be a time when we'll need to make sure we can get the resources that'll maintain the Smithsonian. So it'll always be that place that'll make you proud.
What about the collection? You go into detail about the process of acquiring artifacts like Nat Turner's Bible. When you walk through the museum, there's a Pullman car, a Pullman train car where the Pullman porters worked. There's a guard tower from Angola State Prison in Louisiana. There is the casket that Emmett Till was laid in, who was beaten and mangled beyond all recognition when he was accused of whistling at a white woman in Mississippi, a white woman who later admitted she lied. There are seats from the audience of the Oprah Winfrey Show in Chicago, Michelle Obama's inauguration dresses in there. How do you build that collection?
Well, I think, first of all, what you realized is that we didn't have anything. So I thought, how do we build the collection? Well, part of it was a realization that I thought that most of what we needed was still in the basements, trunks, and attics of people's home. So we went around the country. We did like Antique Roadshow, bring out your stuff. And we helped you preserve grandma's old shawl, that 19th century photograph. But people then brought materials. And suddenly we found, oh my goodness, there's material on Harriet Tubman. There's material on Nat Turner. And I wasn't sure. I mean, I told everybody we can definitely find it, but I wasn't sure. And to be able to find, for me, it was Harriet Tubman. When a collector called me and said he had Harriet Tubman material, and I told him, no, you didn't. And he said, come to Philadelphia and see it. And I said, all right, fine. It's only Philadelphia. And this man was a very big former football player.
Nothing against Philadelphia, by the way. I think you meant it's just a short trip.
Just a short trip.
Okay, I don't want those
short
emails.
Short trip.
Just making sure.
You know,
okay, thank you.
Sure, I love Philadelphia.
Right.
But this guy pulled out a box, and it had pictures of Harriet Tubman's funeral that I had never seen. And I'm so excited, and so is he. And when I pulled it out, he got excited and he punched me. And it hurt. I mean, it hurt. But he pulled out 33 items. And every time he pulled one out, he punched me. I did my best Ali rope-a-dope, but he was hitting me. And then he pulled out Harriet Tubman's hymnal that had all those spirituals she would sing when she went into the South. Steal away Jesus, swing low, sweet chariot. And I'm crying. And suddenly I thought to myself, well, now he's going to want money. I don't have any money. And he basically, I said to him, what's it going to take for this to come to the Smithsonian? He said, shake my hand. So that kind of generosity of people giving from themselves, giving their collections, giving their history is what allowed us to build this museum.
I have to say, I mean, first of all, good on him for just saying, shake my hand. That almost doesn't surprise me in a way because, you know, as black folk, we know how hard it's been to get our story told. So I would think, naively, I would think that once the Smithsonian says we are validating the stories of black people so much that we're building a museum, please take what I have. I don't even know how to take care of it, let alone where to put it, to tell people about it. I would think people would be jumping over each other to give the Smithsonian what they've got.
I think in a way, now that it's open, the answer is yes. I think there was a sense of, is this really going to happen? This idea had been floating around for 100 years. And so I think there was a little hesitancy. But once people saw the building rise out of the ground and said, this is on the National Mall, people were very excited and willing to share their history and their collections.
Tell me a bit about the building, by the way. The architecture of it is very striking. What are some of the elements of the architecture, even if it's just one or two, that you want people to notice, bear in mind, understand as they walk through the museum?
Well, first of all, coming back from Chicago when I ran a museum there, one of the things I realized is how central architecture is to Chicago's history. So I wanted a building that was a signature green building. It was the first sustainable building on the mall. And what I wanted was a building that spoke of uplift and resiliency. So if you look at the building, it's got these sort of angles that are sort of pointing up towards spiritual. And I wanted people to sort of feel that sense. But I also wanted people then to see that there was a dark presence. I wanted a building that reminded us there was always a dark presence in America that got undervalued or overlooked. And then the final piece was, this was going to be a solid bronze building. And you can't have solid bronze. It's too reflective. So the architects, who were brilliant, David Adjaye and Phil Freelon, were going to use a computer to cut holes into the bronze. And I said, I'm paying too much money for holes. So I went down to New Orleans and Charleston and took pictures of all the ironwork that enslaved craft people did. And that's what's on the entire building. So the building itself is a homage to the fact that so much of America's built by people will never know who they are. But that building says, thank you.
There's also something kind of cinematic in a way. It almost has the the thoughtfulness of, and this is not meant to be diminutive, but it almost has the thoughtfulness of like an attraction at Universal or Disney, where like the minute you walk in, the experience begins. This big elevator that holds like 30 some odd people. When it begins, you descend, and there's a timeline on the wall, and you see yourself going back in history, and it gets lower and lower, and it gets darker and darker. And then when the doors open and it's still dark, that's kind of when I, as a museum goer, wasn't quite sure what I had walked into.
Well, in some ways, you put your finger on it. We also did this based on a cinematic feel. We said, if this was a film, what would be those moments of juxtaposition, those moments that would engage, those moments that would frighten you, that moments that you'd find resiliency. So we really thought a lot about it from a cinematic point of view.
Let's get to some of your comments and stories now. C. Wegner tweeted, every American should visit the museum, meaning the National Museum of African American History and Culture. A group from my Mennonite church in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, went soon after it opened. We were all overwhelmed and awestruck. What else don't I know has become my mantra. What are some of the things, Lonnie, that you want people to most walk away from if there are those light bulb moments? Not even just from this museum, but from any of the Smithsonians. Are there any particular light bulb moments that the institution is pushing to make sure more people have?
Well, I think it's, first of all, what you want when you go through any museum is people to find something that inspires them, that gets them excited, or that challenges them to think, as this man said, what don't I know? So I think that's part of the whole Smithsonian notion, that there will be moments of surprise and moments of wonder. But what I want when people go through the African American Museum, I want them to be changed. I want them to either see themselves in a new light if they're African American, to realize that, you know, let's not be embarrassed by our slaved ancestors. Let's wish we were as strong as they were. And if you're not, I want you to understand how your life was shaped by this experience, whether it was the fact that the whole economy of the country was built on the backs of the enslaved, whether it was how our culture has been shaped by the African-American creativity. So the goal was for you to say, this is your story too, regardless of who you are.
Let me play a clip from one of our listeners who shared her experience of going through the Smithsonian. Here's what Shirley left in our inbox.
This is Shirley from Wynwood, Pennsylvania. When I was in college, the Smithsonian had an exhibit called A Nation of Nations, and I used to visit that exhibit quite often. I loved it. They had an old schoolroom, Archie Bunker's chair. They had the ruby slippers and all kinds of interesting bits of Americana and things from American history.
Yeah, Shirley, thank you for sharing your story with us. Lonnie, what about the way that you write the narrative of American history? You know, they say that history is written by the victors, and there's always a perspective, the potential for bias, for slant, for prejudice and stereotype. How do you write the canonical story of America, African Americans, the natural world? Like, that's a gigantic responsibility.
It is something that is humbling, but it's something you can do based on scholarship. Scholarship is the engine of the Smithsonian. You bring together the best scholars from around the world to help you think about, how do you interpret dinosaurs, or how do you explore these questions? And they're always going to be interpretation. Scholars are going to say, I want to do this rather than that. But what we try to do is bring the best scholarship together, and then my own scholars make the final judgment.
But when you've got something like, say, Deep Time, the new exhibit at the Natural History Museum, and you have people who come to the Smithsonian who may, for religious reasons, doubt the theory of evolution, is that exhibit for them too?
Of course it is. In some ways, what we hope is that they will see the best science that is undergirds this. And then at the very least, what you want them to do is ask questions. Well, if my religion says it's not, well, let me think a little bit about what this tells me. So ultimately, what we want to do is, we can't tell every story. We can't make every interpretation the way everybody would like. So what we do is build on the best research we can and to convey those stories that way.
You didn't want that job, being the founding director of the Blacksonian at first, as I understand it.
No, I was happy in Chicago. I also worried that this was such a big job. Could I really do that? And I thought long and hard about it. And then I realized that I kept waiting to hear somebody say that this was a story that was crucial for Black America, but even more important for America. And when I didn't hear other people saying that, then I thought, well, I should at least say it. And the Smithsonian did something very smart. They said, look, I know you don't want the job, but why don't you write for us what the vision should be? Hey, once you get a writer writing, you got me. And so next thing I know, I'm packing up from Chicago, and here I am back in D.C.
Who did you talk to in terms of figuring out that vision?
I talked to an array of scholars who do sort of African-American, but I talked to a lot of my peers that I worked with over my career and said, what do you think about what I want to accomplish? And people got very excited about it. And I knew that in some ways the question was, what should the 21st century museum be? And that's the kind of question that guided us as we created the museum.
One listener tweeted, I tried to go to all the Smithsonians my freshman year at Howard in 2009, a daunting task that I still haven't finished. I still haven't been to the NMAAHC, but it will definitely happen eventually when the tickets aren't sold out. This may be the most important question I ask for the entire hour. What are your tips to get tickets to the Blacksonian? It's almost impossible sometimes.
I am stunned at the crowds. It's so bad that the other day a woman called and asked me for tickets, and I said, I don't do that anymore. And she said, oh, no, no, I was your girlfriend in seventh grade. I need tickets, right? So
Seventh grade?
Now, when you're 13, though, you remember every crush you had, right? I don't remember this woman at all. But I thought it was such a good lie.
A lot has gone on since seventh grade.
I said it was such a good lie, I gave her tickets.
So unless I'm your seventh grade girlfriend.
You're out of luck.
You're out of luck. Okay,
I want a little bit of guidance in terms of how to get tickets for those of you who were not Lonnie Bunch's seventh grade girlfriend or any other grade. Also, we've got some questions from you about the future of the Smithsonian. Plenty to talk about with the other aspects of the institution, including just how it deals with the future and what your future outlook is like for the Smithsonian. So for those of us who are not your seventh grade girlfriend, we will get some of your advice in a minute. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
Can we affect the rise and fall of the economy?
Although things may look good for now, many Wall Street analysts are concerned about the warning signs ahead.
Just by the way we talk about it,
the bond markets once again flashing that ominous recession.
How stories and psychology affect our economic fate. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Back now to our conversation with the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, Lonnie Bunch. You also got to head this first Smithsonian Museum dedicated to Black history and culture under the first Black president, Barack Obama. That must have given it special significance in a way.
Well, I knew the president before he was president in Chicago. And he used to say to me in meetings all along the way, he said, "Now, Lonnie, are you going to get this so that the brother can cut the ribbon?" So it was really important to me to do this under President Obama.
Let a brother cut the ribbon.
Let the brother cut the ribbon.
But the book's subtitle is Creating the Museum in the Age of Bush, Obama, and Trump. Why is that part of the subtitle?
Well, I think it's important to realize that in some ways, the museum wouldn't have been as successful without the support of George Bush. He signed the legislation, but maybe more importantly, when there were a lot of people who said, this museum isn't important enough to be on the mall, he stood up and said, yes, it should. So it helped me when I began to struggle with people to say, of course it should be on the mall. The president said so. And I think it's important then to recognize that we're in a time where politics changes the debate and the discourse. But the Smithsonian is always that sort of safe space where you can have those debates. And so for me, it's important to recognize that regardless of the administration, the Smithsonian, that museum, will be there to be able to challenge, engage, and help people remember.
You credit President Bush for speaking very eloquently at the opening of the museum, right?
I think it was the best speech he ever gave, where he talked about how a great nation confronts its past, doesn't run away from its history. And I think in a way, as a historian, to me, that is the most powerful thing, to say that history matters, because history is not about yesterday. It's about today and tomorrow. And that's what President Bush was saying.
What about in the age of President Trump? How much has the Trump administration, if at all, affected the Museum of African American History and Culture, or the Smithsonian and at large, in a larger sense?
I think at this stage, the Smithsonian has the support that it's had with every administration. There hasn't been anybody that says, okay, let's attack the Smithsonian. I think that what is important, though, is that in a divisive political age, our job should be is to provide opportunities for people to have reasoned debate, reasoned discussion. And as long as that museum is there, issues of race will always be at the heart of our national dialogue.
What has the scholarship of the Smithsonian been like, if any, in terms of cataloging and chronicling the Trump administration? I feel like one of the things that we will need when we look back on any administration is kind of an arm's length view of what happened, how it happened, why it happened.
I think one of the things that a museum does is collect today for tomorrow. So there might be stories that you might not explore in the next couple of years, but you want to make sure that a curator 50 years from now has the material, has the stories they want to tell. So we made sure, for example, that we collected a lot of things around Ferguson, for example. We collected ideas and stories around Charlottesville. When we went to Baltimore to look at the sort of murder of Freddie Gray, what we did was actually ask people to share their videos they made on their cameras. So we have other ways that people would interpret these things. And some of that will be used in the museum currently, but a lot of it won't be used for a few more years down the road.
I know there are plenty of people who are not fans of this current president, who would like for history to remember him as the worst president who ever served, as a pox on America, as an aberration, as a fluke, as a mistake of American democracy. And they want that to be the record of the Trump administration. What would you say to them?
I would say it's our job to collect the Trump administration in its totality, and I'll leave that interpretation to historians in the future.
Quite a few school teachers have brought classes through the Smithsonian. Here is what one teacher in South Carolina left in our inbox.
This is Sarah calling from Blacksburg, South Carolina. I was a lucky 6th and 7th grade teacher in another small town in South Carolina, and I took children to the Smithsonian for the first time. They saved their money for a year to go to Washington, D.C. But seeing and being among the artifacts, the historical treasures of the Smithsonian, the wide-eyed children of this small town brought chill bumps to my arms.
Sarah, thank you very much for sharing that story. Much appreciated. You are the first African-American to serve as the secretary of the Smithsonian. Museum science is not one of those places where we see a lot of black. You're kind of the Neil deGrasse Tyson of museum science. What about diversity in museum leadership?
My whole career has been about changing the canon, making sure that museums recognize that they can't serve a community if they're not as diverse as that community. It's important to me to say, look, I am not the diversity secretary. However, because it is so key to me to say, you can't understand your science, your history, your art, without reflecting the diversity of this country, that's key, whether it is in terms of making sure the museums do a better job of exploring Latino issues or women's issues, whether it is making sure that on our boards that we have a much more diverse cadre of people. So in essence, for me, it's about saying, if we're going to reflect America, shape America, then what we do have to reflect that diversity and embrace that diversity.
Is that a matter of the pipeline of people who want to get into museum sciences? Are there just not enough young African-Americans who even consider it as a career?
It's a variety of things. Part of it's the pipeline. I mean, I think that what I recognize is that my career has contributed to a visibility where suddenly I see younger people, younger African-Americans, younger Latinos saying, well, this might be a career for me as well. So it's both creating the more effective pipeline, but I believe maybe more than anything else, it's making sure people see themselves in museums. If people go in and see Latino culture, then people are saying, I want to be part of this. I want to help reshape that. So that's why it's so important for the Smithsonian to reflect that diversity.
You've also been vocal about Confederate monuments, which is one of the things that we've debated since and around Charlottesville, New Orleans, Richmond, etc. You've been vocal about them while also noting that, in your words, quote, reckoning with lost stories and new fears will not be accomplished by simply tearing down Confederate monuments, unquote. What do you think we should do with these monuments?
I'm a firm believer that, one, pruning is what we do. Some should be taken down. But I think there should be an opportunity to contextualize and explore this. What I think when I talked to Mayor Mitch Landrieu in New Orleans when he took down monuments, I said, it's important for people to understand what these monuments really were. That most of these monuments were done well after the Civil War, and they were about white supremacy. And then the ones, the second wave that were done during the Civil Rights Movement, were really ways to say, we oppose the changes of the Civil Rights Movement. I want people to understand that. And I think if you just erase them, you can't do that. So I would argue that one of the best places I love is a park in Hungary where they took all the old Soviet statues and said, this is part of our history, and interpret them for the public to understand what they mean.
This is big for you. I mean, you are the grandson of a sharecropper who worked a plantation outside Raleigh, North Carolina. Now you are the head of the world's largest museum and research institution. That's got to hit you hard sometimes.
What it hits me is it makes me realize the power of African-American families. For people who basically believed in an America that didn't believe in them, who said education was the key. And so I think how important it was for my grandparents to decide to change their lives, which reminds me how important it is for all of us to struggle to make a country better, to make our families better, because their actions transformed my life. Otherwise, I might still be picking cotton.
Last question. If you had a day to go see the Smithsonian, not as the secretary,
just to enjoy part of it for a day, where would you go? What would you see?
I love going to the art museums. When I walk through the Smithsonian Art Museums, I find new ways to understand myself. I find a sense of beauty, and I find a sense of calm, which I'm always in search of.
Lonnie Bunch is the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution and the founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. His new book is called A Fool's Errand. Mr. Secretary, we appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
This conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.